window, piercing the wood with spots of sunlight and sending splinters everywhere. One of the three soldiers slumped over as Durand and Thet dove for cover next to Frey. The other two soldiers climbed out on deck. The long-tailed boat pitched right, then left again, as the soldiers moved to the gunwales and opened fire on an incoming drone chopper. Tracers still streamed out of the jungle toward the evasive, fast-moving aircraft. Thet looked to the stern of the boat, shouted, then got up and raced aft. Durand turned to see the boat's pilot was missing. The entire rear of their boat had been speckled with bullet holes. The engine was still running, but unattended, the long-tail propeller slalomed from side to side. They were making little progress toward shore. Thet crawled across the deck to grab the throttle. Durand moved to check the pulse of the soldier who'd slumped over in the cabin. He laid the man down next to Frey and could see there was a sucking chest wound. The unconscious man struggled for breath with his other lung, blood spilling out of him. Durand pulled a can of wound sealant from the man's web harness, bit the cap off, and inserted the sterile tip into the worst of the bleeding, pressing the actuator. The medical coagulant oozed out, covering the wound. He shouted at Frey, "You're a doctor, aren't you?"
"Not that sort of doctor."
He covered his head as more bullets snapped in. The soldiers fired their M4s into the air just outside. Between shots and the roar of the engine, Frey shouted, "We need to get off this goddamned river!" Durand looked back at Thet directing the Longtail's rudder. A chopper flew past, ripping the deck with bullets and detonating the fuel tank. Flames roared into the cabin as Durand hit the deck again. The flames receded, but the boat's engine died. Durand looked up to see that Thet was gone. The aft deck was on fire. Durand raced toward the stern, past the smoking engine, and looked out behind them through the flames. Thet's body lay face down in the current some ways back. Glancing over his shoulder, Durand could see the boat was nearly to shore, and clearly had the momentum to reach it. Durand tossed his cup and pulled off his tunic, then dove into the silted river. He surfaced, feeling the current draw him onward, away from the flaming boat as it impacted the riverbank. Durand swam as fast as he could toward Thet's body, rolling with the slow current. As he did so, he saw yellow and green tracers rip across the sky. One of the choppers pinwheeled in flames 1,000 meters downrange, but he also saw more choppers cresting the distant ridge. Durand swam harder and heard the same buzzsaw sound they'd heard in the middle of the night, and only now realized it was what you heard right before one of these damn things flew over you. Durand dove deep into the water and heard high-velocity rounds whip into the water all around him, slowing almost instantly. Moments later, he burst back to the surface to see the fiery turbofan at the tail end of a receding chopper, racing across the water, chased by tracers streaming from both shores. Durand reached Thet and grabbed him by the tunic collar, rolling him face up. He then wrapped an arm around the man's chest and pulled him backward, as he'd been trained in innumerable Navy rescue drills. His arms felt powerful, capable, and he pulled for shore, simultaneously checking Thet for visible wounds. He didn't see any bullet punctures on the front of the man's tunic, but he did see a nasty, bleeding gash on Thet's head. He focused on pulling him to shore as chopper engines, gunfire, and bullets tore up the air overhead. Minutes later, Durand came into the shallows under the shade of thorny acacia trees, roughly 500 meters downriver from where the long-tailed boat burned on shore. He strained to pull Thet up onto the bank, and then did a fireman's carry to bring him into the jungle. There, Durand laid Thet down and checked for breathing and a pulse. He found neither and started doing CPR, pressing the heel of his palm at a measured pace as river water bubbled out of Thet's throat and his head wound bled. Durand heard thrashing in the brush nearby and looked up to see two Shan resistance fighters emerge. They put down their weapons and came to assist. Durand pointed at the bleeding scalp wound before returning his focus to CPR. The men broke out field dressings and applied pressure while the gunfire still raged out on the river. Moments later, Thet coughed out the last of the water and gasped for air. Several moments after that, he opened his eyes. Durand stopped the compression. He looked into Thet's eyes.
You see me? Do you see me?
Thet nodded.
Follow my finger.
What's your name?
Thet Golin.
Good. Durand looked up to meet the gaze of the soldiers.
Go see if Dr. Frey is okay.
Thet coughed again, and to Durand's surprise, he translated Durand's instructions to the two men. The two soldiers put Thet's arms over them and followed as Durand blazed a trail back upriver. The gunfire and chopper noise had begun to die down. After several minutes of thrashing through the undergrowth, they could hear orders being shouted. It was a voice Durand recognized, Bo Win. They emerged from the brush to see a dozen soldiers pulling boxes out of the still-burning long-tail boat. One of the soldiers shouted and pointed at Thet being carried. Several of the men moved to help. Win raced to the front of them, talking fast. Thet waved her away as she tried to examine his head wound. Durand watched them go while others remained to unload the weapons and ammunition from the boat.
I'm alive, in case you're curious.
Durand turned to see Frey holding a bandage against his own bleeding scalp.
I could use some sealant, I think.
We need to get inland.
A shout went up at the sound of approaching jets. The Shan grabbed the last of the crates, motioning for Durand and Frey to move. That night, unseen aircraft crisscrossed the skies for miles around their camp, thundering jets and autonomous choppers, but the Shan fighters lay concealed beneath a rock outcropping, hemmed in close by artocarpus trees and a heavy jungle canopy. Most of the weapons and other supplies had made it across the river, but several of their fighters had been killed, wounded, or were still missing. Likewise, a couple boats were still hiding in tributaries on the eastern bank. But they would follow in coming days. Still, Durand counted at least twice as many people now and saw new faces. Apparently, they'd linked up with some other group. Durand could see Bo Win speaking gravely with another Shan commander as they examined maps on LFP glasses over near the base of the rock face. Word had come down that the supply column would be moving onward at dawn. Thet was in a makeshift infirmary tent among other wounded. Frey and Durand had lost their interpreter for the time being. Instead, Durand heard the Shan fighters whispering as he passed by. They smiled and bowed wise to him. He knew his tattoos were still visible. A glance at his arms showed they had not faded at all, even hours after the river crossing. Later, while Durand sat in the darkness trying to remember the contours of Miyuki's face, he became aware that the men around him were making room for someone walking through. He looked up and barely discerned Bo Win's features from the reflected light of a three-quarter moon. Durand stood and bowed, peeking his hands. She stood silently before him for several moments, then put her hands together and bowed, looking back up at him. She said in halting English,
My thanks for brother, Mr. Durin.
He bowed to her again. Her expression softened for just a moment, then Win moved on, slipping between her soldiers, who all looked back at Durand in the darkness. He could feel their eyes on him. Durand longed to be home, to be himself, and yet the trajectory of his life could be very different. He sensed how thin the cord was that tied him to himself. Frey sat up from the shadows nearby.
You saved Thet's life?
Durand nodded. Frey's eyes followed Win.
Good.
He got comfortable on his bamboo mat.
I rather like that.
Chapter 35. Morning brought rain again and low cloud cover, but the men broke camp in good spirits because it wasn't drone weather. The column marched in silence along freshly hacked trails and into a broad jungle valley, parsed by streams and swamps. The ground churned almost immediately to mud with the passage of hooves and feet. Mid-morning, Durand came alongside Thet's litter. Two soldiers carried the man on a folding carbon fiber frame. Thet smiled broadly.
Mr. Durand, they say you saved me.
Then we're even, Thet. You and your sister are saving me right now.
Thet pointed.
Your tattoos, they are visible today.
Durand looked down at his arms and nodded, unsure whether they'd ever go away again.
The men believe your tattoos protected you from the drones back at the river.
Durand said nothing. Instead, he bowed a Y to Thet and moved ahead. Soon Frey, riding Tuck, fell in behind Durand.
What's going on with you exactly?
Durand walked in silence.
It's rather easy to notice when you're upset.
You wear it on your sleeve.
Durand cast an annoyed glance at Frey.
I can feel myself slipping away. That's what's going on.
Are you losing your connection to the chromatophores?
I'm having trouble remembering what I was like, how it felt to be Kenneth Durand.
He examined his arms.
There are things I don't even think about anymore.
Frey contemplated this.
So, tell me something about Kenneth Durand.
I told you I...
Surely you remember Kenneth Durand's life. Experience makes us who we are. So, where did Kenneth Durand come from, anyway? And what possessed him to go to the Naval Academy, of all things? It seemed a rather jingoistic choice. Enlighten me.
Durand walked in brooding silence for a bit.
It wasn't a choice. It was a goal. We were poor. I told myself that my mother and my brother and sister were counting on me to succeed.
Well, you did succeed. You should be proud.
But I never really came back.
Durand picked up his pace and moved ahead in the column. That evening, they camped in a narrow defile with a waterfall and idyllic pool of water nearby. Durand moved through the camp to smiles and nods. He noticed that Thet was sitting up and drinking tea now, laughing as he spoke to the other men. While helping to string up the anti-drone nets, Durand put his comprehensive knot skills to use and demonstrated a quick-release highwayman's knot several times to Shan fighters, who observed his hands closely. The language barrier made it easier to focus on his actual hand movements. The men were fast learners, and they soon put that clever knot to use, smiling at him. While crossing camp, Durand passed Bo Win. They nodded and continued, though he felt their shared gaze linger a moment longer than necessary. He spent the remainder of the night with an unsettled feeling. In the darkness, he pulled out the photo of his family, but he could not see it. Instead, he thumbed its surface. After a fitful sleep, Durand awoke in the pre-dawn. The chorus of insects drowned out the thin waterfall nearby. He eased out from between the other sleeping fighters and walked toward the pool of water. He splashed the cool water over his face and ran his hand through it. In the evening, he hadn't noticed that the water was so clear, the first clear water he'd seen in this mountainous, mud-filled jungle. Pre-dawn, and it was already in the high 70s, and he could see tunics drying on branches. He pulled off his own tunic and eased into the water. It was only a couple meters deep.
He swam along the bank, feeling the coolness seep into him. He rolled over to gaze at the canopy above. He listened to the calls of tropical birds. Water cascaded down from a cliff face 50 meters high. He suddenly wondered if there were poisonous snakes in the pool. It startled him upright in the water. Durand turned toward the bank and noticed Bo Win was standing there. At first, he thought she might be angry with him for taking a swim, but her expression remained neutral. He reached for the bank and pulled himself up through the brush. He whined to her silently. She still stared at him. Durand looked around to see if the camp was stirring, but the sun had not yet touched the eastern horizon. Only the sentries on the perimeter were awake. He felt her hand brush his arm, and he looked down to see she was there next to him, a head shorter than he. Close. Wynn spoke softly in the Shan dialect. Just then, Durand wanted more than anything to understand her as he watched her beautiful eyes catch reflected light. The desire, he felt, began to consume him. With effort, he recalled his family, his wife and daughter. He knew it shouldn't require effort, but at that moment, Kenneth Durand seemed more like a man he once knew than his true self. This was becoming his real life. And it fit him. He felt at home in chaos. But that wasn't true. He knew it wasn't. He'd loved everything about his old life, even if he couldn't see it now. But a realization nearly crushed him. Was he going through the motions? Striving toward a goal because Kenneth Durand wanted it? There was a void where his rage had once been. He felt the driving force of it fading. This had to be some evolved trait, some plasticity of the human mind to adapt to new circumstances. He felt his grip on Durand weakening. Wynne was looking with concern into his eyes, and she seemed to sense that he was struggling with intense emotions. She clasped his hand. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes. He tried to imagine his wife's face. He could not. He opened his eyes to see Wynne. If she moved to him, he could not resist her. He knew that now, and he knew she sensed it too. Wynne gazed at him for several moments and then leaned her head against his shoulder. He stroked her hair as they stood this way for a moment. And then she pushed slowly away from him, looking up with eyes that seemed to say, "In some other life." Wynne then turned and moved silently toward the camp. Durand felt as if he teetered on the edge of a precipice he had only just now noticed. He knelt on the ground, the faces of his wife and daughter coming to him clearly now. The realization that he'd been ready, willing, to leave them behind brought tears to his eyes. He wept silently. He needed to get his identity back. The anger had returned, but he could not help wonder how much longer it would remain. How long would he be able to perceive his current self as the other before his old self started to fade? But then he noticed his arms in the dim light. The Huli Jing tattoos had faded, suddenly gone. He stood and focused his mind. He was Kenneth Durand. Kenneth Durand. Durand marched with the lead fighters that day, staying near the front, keeping his thoughts to himself as they came down out of the Burmese highlands. Through occasional gaps between the trees, he could see low foothills and a broad valley ahead, miles across with the far side lost in haze. The men seemed more at ease here, and sure enough, Durand could see a patchwork of rice paddies on the valley floor ahead.
By evening, they walked along a berm with rice paddies to either side. Water buffalo wallowed in brown creeks nearby, and they could see farmers knee-deep in water waving welcome. The fighters waved back. Eventually, the column entered a small village like something from a bygone age. The thatched roof huts were raised on bamboo stilts, and yet there were solar panels and satellite dishes, too. Durand could see 3D printers in tool sheds and a gray-haired man wearing LFP glasses motioning with his hands as he manipulated virtual objects. Bo Win moved past Durand, heading to the front to meet the village elder, who came out to greet them, along with barking dogs and lots of barefoot children in t-shirts and tunics. There was smiling and hugging. Frey's donkey came up along with the rest of the pack train, and he laboriously dismounted to the great amusement of the children, who gathered around him laughing. Ah, yes, the funny little dwarf. The honesty of children. How refreshing. He smiled at them. Durand watched Bo Win. She saluted a trim, dignified-looking man in military uniform who had emerged from a corrugated metal building with several other soldiers, automatic rifles slung over their shoulders. After listening for a few moments, they invited her inside.
What do you figure that's all about?
Frey walked up alongside. Reporting in, she'll pass along information about us, no doubt. Durand watched the door close behind her. That night, the resistance fighters sat around a long wooden table, sharing platters of rice, stir-fried vegetables, wooden bowls of soup, and bottled beer. The men laughed and spoke over one another. They seemed elated to have survived another supply run. Glad to be near home. Durand watched them, envious. Frey sat next to Thet, who was up and walking now, though with a line of pale blue wound sealant running across his scalp.
Tell me, Thet, where do we go from here?
Most of these men will head north tomorrow. My sister awaits instructions from superiors.
Regarding us?
Thet nodded. Frey gestured to the pork rice Durand was eating.
I thought you were a deacon.
Fuck off.
Thet raised his eyebrows.
You prefer deathless meat, Mr. Durand?
Durand looked up.
I didn't become a Deegan for spiritual reasons. It was for my daughter. It's better for the environment.
Frey snorted. Our environment, he means, not the pigs, clearly. Because that's what we mean when we say the environment, right?
Durand cast an annoyed look Frey's way.
Though I suppose transhumanists might use this change agent technology to edit their lungs to metabolize a different gas mixture. Then there will indeed be a big struggle over saving the environment. Whose environment? I'd say we're heading toward an increasingly disordered world, Thet. Though the local picture in places like Singapore and London might be very pleasant indeed, I don't imagine we are going to remain a single species for much longer.
Pity.
Thet pointed. Durand and Frey turned to see Wynne emerge from the communication shed. She motioned to her brother in coded hand signals. He nodded back at her.
I will need to make preparations. Apparently, you are going north.
Chapter 36. The next morning, they boarded a long-tail boat on a nearby canal under a sky that threatened rain, thunder rumbling ominously in the foothills. Most of the other fighters had moved on before dawn. Accompanying Durand and Frey were Bo Win, Thet, three resistance fighters, and a farmer piloting the boat. All of them were dressed in indigo-dyed tunics made of homespun fabric with baggy pants cinched beneath their shirts. More importantly, they all wore the conical bamboo hats as they clambered aboard, with Durand and Frey shielding their faces from the sky. Given the resolution of drone surveillance platforms and the amount of both Western and Eastern equipment sold to the regime, Duran knew that security was a real concern. Moments after boarding, the powerful engine of the Longtail roared to life, and they soon raced down the canal at a considerable speed. Water Buffalo fled onto the banks as they approached. Keeping the coop on his head took considerable effort with the wind, but Durand poked his head up high enough to gaze out onto mist-filled rice paddies to either side. He noticed Bo Wynn doing the same. She met his gaze without intent. Whatever had passed between them 2 days before, she had moved on. Bo Wynn must have made the case to bring Durand and Frey to her leadership. She had put her reputation on the line for him. The boat soon joined a narrow river that snaked through the low foothills of the Burmese highlands. Reeds and bamboo forests closed in on either side. Ruins of ancient brick temples rose from the bush, overgrown and shattered from either time or earlier conflicts. Durand guessed they must have been centuries old. The temple ruins increased in number, and as they came around a bend in the river, they soon emerged into a large lake. They left the coast behind and raced out over the dark blue water. Durand could make out rounded hills kilometers away on the far shore. Traditional fishermen were already out on the lake, standing on one leg in their narrow wooden boats and rowing a stern oar with the other leg as they cast homemade nets. It was a scene that must have been occurring here every morning for 1,000 years. The sense of permanence calmed Durand. In the water behind these fishermen stood whitewashed domed stupas and chettas. They rose from the water's surface, creating a maze. Some lay in ruins, others were still bright white. Some even had gold pinnacles, catching the sun's light as it crested the horizon. They passed between the holy sites, their wake lapping against the aging brick at the waterline. By midday, the boat approached a large Buddhist monastery with curving tiled roofs. Saffron-robed monks walked the grounds, and a massive, vine-choked stone temple rose behind it. The boat slowed, and the farmer eased the bow onto a gravel beach. Young, bald-headed monks came to assist them in disembarking, reaching to hold hands as the passengers hopped down. Yet they did not touch Bo Wynn, instead keeping a respectful distance. Whether by social custom or due to her position, Durand did not know. The monks had no outward response to Frey's dwarfism and assisted him out of the boat and onto shore with great care. Frey joined Durand on the beach, looking back at the young monks.
"They seem nice."
Durand nodded toward Thet, who was motioning for them to follow. Wynn was already well ahead. Her men remained back in the boat, weapons concealed. Durand and Frey caught up with Thet. Durand took in the enormity and age of the ornate structure as they walked beneath its stone arches. He could see dozens of robed monks of all ages watching them and smiling, some of them bowing in greeting.
"Where are we, Thet?"
Thet put his hands together.
"So sorry, I cannot say, Mr. Durand."
He brought Durand and Frey deeper into the ancient building. Soon, the sights and smells changed from incense to something more like a hospital. As they followed Wynn, Durand was shocked as they passed wards containing deformed children playing on the wooden floors or sleeping in cribs while robed monks cared for them. The children ranged in age from infancy to 6 or 7 years old. Bamar, Shan, or Karen, Durand couldn't tell. But their genetic deformities made him wince despite his best efforts. Double-faced or with multiple arms and legs, misshapen bodies that curled upon themselves. This wasn't some random situation. He knew it was the result of reckless genetic editing. His heart sank at the sight of them. Children crying in discomfort and intractable confusion tore at his parental instincts.
that. My God, what is this?
Dihulijing. They experiment on embryos to, how do you say, map gene expression. They allow all their experiments to gestate to birth and carefully record the results. Most are destroyed. Some, like these, are discarded.
Frey moved into one of the doorways and looked as though he was on the edge of a breakdown. He gazed out upon the children, his mouth moving wordlessly. There were dozens of children in view, and possibly many more in the rooms and wards beyond. Frey finally said,
"The monks care for them."
Thet nodded.
"They say they are trapped in these bodies for this life."
Frey appeared on the verge of tears.
"This wasn't karma. They didn't deserve this. No child deserves this."
He turned to Thet.
"I have some medical training. Some may be suffering from disorders that can be ameliorated. My skills might be of some use."
"I am certain the monks would be very glad of your assistance, Dr. Frey."
Frey looked out at the ward again.
"To be an active intellect imprisoned in a non-functioning body. I sometimes forget how fortunate I am."
Thet tugged at Frey's sleeve.
"We must follow Bo Win, please."
Frey nodded, and they all three continued down the corridor, past genetically monstrous children playing with smiling monks. They walked through towering, carved wooden doors into a room lined with representations of the Buddha in many manifestations, some fashioned in gold, jade, and opal, others in wood or stone. Bo Win had removed her kup, and both Durand and Frey did likewise. She turned and spoke rapidly in the Shan dialect as they approached. Thet translated.
"My sister asks that you release your final payment, Dr. Frey."
Frey's face fell and then morphed into irritation.
"Standing as we are in a place of spiritual enlightenment, and so recently passing through a place of severe human suffering, I'm not particularly of a mind to discuss money right now, Bo Win."
Thet relayed Frey's words, and Wynne's face hardened. She replied immediately.
"My sister says that you can tell your sister that the deal was that I would arrange for payment when Mr. Durand and I were both safely arrived in Naypyidaw. This does not look like Naypyidaw."
Thet spoke for several moments, exchanging terse words with Wynne.
"My sister says that the arrangement changed when Mr. Durand revealed that he has been genetically transformed into the leader of the Hulijing."
Durand interjected. "How has it changed, Thet?" Wynne turned to Durand. She spoke in Shan, but looked into Durand's eyes. Thet's English words overlaid her own.
"I have beseeched my leaders on your behalf. I await word from them. My people may do a great deal more than merely deliver you to the capital. We may try to help you succeed."
She added in English of her own,
"Mr. Durin."
Durand felt shame. The intensity in her eyes had many dimensions. Was it faith in him? Conviction of her cause? He looked down and then placed his hands together before him, bowing deeply to her. Durand then spoke to Frey without looking. "Give her the money."
"What do you mean, give her the money? We're
alive because of her. I trust her and Thet with my life." He looked up. "You should too."
"Oh, and you're a great judge of character all of a sudden?"
"I trusted you, didn't I?" Frey was about to argue, but stopped. "Give her the code for the wallet."
"The entire 400,000?
"Yes. Let's be done with this. They'll need the money. Look around you." Frey was already nodding.
"Okay. I'm just not used to changing a deal."
He looked up to Thet.
Can you please give me a pen, Thet?
Yes, of course.
Thet searched in his shoulder bag and came up with a pen and a worn leather-bound notepad.
Oh, I like this. Can I keep this?
Brian. Frey cast an irritated glance at Durand, then jotted several codes onto the paper. He stabbed the last dot with a flourish before handing over the pad and pen.
There you go.
Thet nodded and placed his hands together.
Thank you, Dr. Frey. The money is very much needed by our cause, particularly in light of upcoming expenses.
He spoke to Bo Wynn as he handed her the notepad. She examined it, and then nodded to Frey, and finally turned to Durand. She then departed. Durand watched her go. What now, Thet? Thet grimaced.
It will take some days until our leaders make a decision. Until then, we have concealed rooms in the monastery. Please, follow me.
Chapter 37 Over the next several days, Durand walked the grounds among ancient wats, stupas, and crumbling statues. Thet insisted Durand remain out of sight, though the same prohibition wasn't extended to Frey, who had taken to working with the genetically altered orphans in the ward. At times, Durand could see Frey interacting with patients through grillwork that provided a veiled view into the main hall. It was as though a stranger had possessed Frey. Durand barely recognized the gene hacker he'd hired back in Johor. Frey was kind and patient with the deformed children in his care, making kid jokes that another monk translated. Durand supposed Frey could identify with these children, trapped as they were in bodies they did not choose. It was an increasingly common malady. Durand remained hidden, pacing around a courtyard, circling the base of a towering Buddha damaged in some ancient war. Burmese cats were his main companions. No one else seemed to come to this place. The cats climbed onto his lap to sleep and purr. They distracted him from his anxieties for a time. But then he'd remember his daughter's Toigar and start to worry about the Shan leadership's decision and what was taking so long. 2 days had already passed since their payment. On the third day, late in the afternoon, an elderly monk wearing printed plastic eyeglasses and a saffron robe entered through an iron-bound wooden gate. He looked to be in his late 80s and clicked along with a cane. His exposed shoulders still looked fit. The monk's expression changed from serenity to apparent surprise at the sight of Durand. It occurred to Durand that very few knew he was here. The elderly monk bowed a shallow Y in greeting, smiling. Durand stood up from a stone bench, a cat leaping from his lap. He bowed a deep Y in return. The monk then commenced slowly walking around the base of the Buddha shrine, deep in contemplation. He worked beads in his free hand as he did so. Every so often he would pass in front of Durand as he walked ancient stone slabs. On one of his laps, he looked to Durand and softly said,
"Dukkha."
Durand looked up. "Sorry, I don't speak."
"The word refers to suffering,"
he said in English. He gestured with his free hand.
"A longing for what isn't. I see it on your face. Worry."
"You speak English." The monk spoke with a British accent.
"Some still learn English."
He refocused on Durand.
"You are consumed with worry."
Durand nodded. "I have good reason to worry."
"Do you?"
The old monk moved over to him and eased down onto the bench.
"And what do you worry about?"
Durand looked toward the mountains. "I need to get home."
"Craving leads to disappointment and sorrow. This we call dukkha, suffering. It is one of the two characteristics of sankhara, conditioned phenomena through which we perceive the physical world.
Durand sighed in irritation. He appreciated the old man's concern, but at the same time, platitudes weren't going to solve anything. I'll bear that in mind.
What you do is up to you, but be conscious of what you do. Why do you worry?
Durand recalled the compassion these monks displayed to the disfigured orphans in their care, and he took a more conciliatory tone. I worry that I will never see my home or my wife and daughter again.
But at some point this will be true, no matter what you do.
Durand paused. Very powerful people want to make sure it happens now.
And so you suffer.
Durand nodded.
I was a biochemist until my 50s.
Durand looked up in surprise.
Oh, yes, in Hyderabad. That was fine for many years.
Why did you leave it?
Because everyone I loved perished in a flood.
My God, I'm so sorry.
No one was to blame.
Durand remained silent.
Theravada Buddhism follows the Pali Canon, a collection of the oldest Buddhist texts. They teach us that life has but three characteristics, the first of which is anicca, impermanence. All conditioned phenomena are subject to change. Physical characteristics, assumptions, theories, knowledge. Nothing is permanent because all things are bound together recursively, and as one changes, so too do the others. It is longing to stop this change that causes the second characteristic, dukkha, suffering.
Why wouldn't we want to stop some change? If you could go back, wouldn't you? To be with those you love?
But I cannot go back. And if I did, I am already a different person than the one they knew.
Durand stopped himself. An image of stabbing a man repeatedly in the back came into his mind again, his voice hoarse with rage, of standing in the darkness next to Bo Win. He looked back up at the monk. I'm losing myself. I can feel the person I knew slipping away. I need to get back.
And if you did get back, Mr. Durand?
Durand cast a wary look at the old man.
Would you be back?
Durand strained to answer honestly. He finally straightened and looked into the elder monk's eyes. That doesn't matter. I don't matter. I want to be there for them, even if I'm not completely the same.
They tell me you have been genetically edited.
Durand suddenly realized he was not speaking with merely an elderly monk. Yes. This, he gestured to his body, his face, isn't who I am.
And you believe your genomic sequence is intrinsically your identity?
Part of me, yes.
It is not something you chose, but something the universe thrust upon you. Yet you call it you.
It's the form my daughter calls Dad, and it's half her DNA, what I brought to the union my wife and I made.
Anatta, the third characteristic of life, the not-self. There is no permanent atta or self. From the moment we begin, all entities, including living beings, are subject to a process of continuous change.
I understand that wise men might tell me it's foolish to cling to the physical, that all things turn to dust. He gestured to the ruined stone statue. But I want my body for as long as I can have it. I will let it go, but not yet. He searched the monk's eyes. Being a husband and father, that was taken from me not by fate, but by men. Selfish, cruel men who enslave millions,
who have created and cast away the deformed children you care for. I want to take back from them my physical form and make certain they never do this to anyone else." He shook his head. "You may be wiser than me, and I may have a lot to learn about suffering and impermanence, but I would crawl through fire to get back to my wife and child, to see them look at me with love in their eyes just one more time. I would give anything for that. Anything. Am I a perfect man? No. I'm not even a particularly good man. I have in the past done horrible things. I lie awake at night thinking of the harm I've done to people I'll never know. But just this one thing that is wholly good that I helped create, my little girl. I promised my wife that I would try to make the world a better place for her, and if I'm going to die here, then let me at least do that. Help me destroy the Hulijing. Help me stop them, even if it kills me." The monk sat in silence regarding Durand for several moments. Then he got to his sandaled feet.
"Bring an end to your suffering, Mr. Durand."
With that, the elderly monk clicked his cane on the slabs of ancient stone as he walked away, through the gate and into the monastery beyond. Chapter 38. That evening, Durand, Frey, and Thet sat in Durand's tiny cell eating wooden bowls of a chicken and coconut curry. Thet refused to discuss the elder monk Durand had met, but he was willing to discuss the Hulijing.
"You've seen the results of some of their experiments. They do this to those they've enslaved in prison camps outside the city. But there is much going on inside the city. Private jets come and go at all hours, foreigners from around the globe. Our people check the tail numbers. Many are untraceable."
Durand looked to Thet. "Do these planes have windows or no windows?" Frey looked up.
"You think they might be renditions?"
Thet shook his head.
"These planes have many windows, very luxurious service staff, many domestics. Some are big planes, Boeing, Comac, Airbus, privately owned. Many bodyguards, Arab, Russian, Chinese, American, many nationalities."
Durand pondered this information. "Some services people are willing to pay big money for." Just then, a monk in saffron robes appeared in the doorway and bowed, smiling. Incongruously, he held a device shaped like a laser pistol. He spoke rapidly to Thet, who got up from his perch in the window frame. Thet nodded and accepted the device from the young monk, who then departed, closing the door. Thet turned to Durand and Frey as he powered on the device.
"Gentlemen, if you would please disrobe."
Frey raised his eyebrows.
"Excuse me?"
"What's going on, Thet?"
"I need to scan your bodies for an accurate reading."
He tested the scanner against the wall. Red laser light splayed across it.
"You should ideally be nude."
The next day, Durand and Frey were confined to their shortened wing of the monastery. The confinement was to all evidence voluntary, but Thet asked them not to leave their rooms, and they honored his request. Instead, Frey spent his time pacing back and forth in Durand's monk cell while Durand lay on the cot. It was mercifully not as hot near the lake, but their shutters had been closed, sealed from the outside, making it stifling just the same. It was beginning to feel as though they were prisoners. Frey stopped.
"What the hell did you say to that old monk anyway?"
"We talked about impermanence and dukkha, suffering. From what I've experienced, suffering is reliably permanent. I think he just wanted to meet me." "Do you think you've worn out our welcome?" A knock. They both looked up to see the door open. The elder monk stood in the doorway with several other monks in robes standing behind him.
The elder monk nodded to Durand and then Frey, then entered, clicking his cane on the stone floor. The younger monks followed and began setting up what looked like mirrors and folding dressing tables.
"Good evening, gentlemen."
Durand stood and bowed away, as did Frey. Frey asked,
"Pardon my asking, but are we your prisoners now?"
The monk laughed and shook his head.
"You have been exceptionally kind to our lost children, Dr. Frey. You help make the burden of life easier for some."
"I'm glad I could make some use of the machines I brought, and children usually find me hilarious."
"What's all this?"
Durand gestured toward the monks who were laying out what looked to be expensive dinner jackets, black bow ties, and shoes. The elder monk turned.
"Your new identities. An American businessman and his colleague are missing tonight in Rangoon. They had an appointment with the Hulijing. You might wish to take their place."
Durand stood and examined the black tie outfits.
"You're helping us?"
The monk motioned to another monk, who produced a corrugated carbon fiber briefcase with a chain leading to an open handcuff. He also held the key. The young monk placed the briefcase on the bed and clicked it open, stepping back. The elder monk looked to Durand.
"A great deal of corrupt money has entered our country. It poisons men's hearts."
Durand and Frey walked up and looked into the case. Inside were individual jewel sleeves snugged into slots in a black velvet interior. Durand drew out one and pressed its sides to open its mouth. He drew a breath, then poured a dozen large rubies onto the bed. Frey examined the dozens of other packets, peeking into several, weighing them with his hands.
"My God, these must be worth millions."
$43 million U.S. dollars at current prices, Dr. Frey."
Momentarily speechless, Frey turned to look at the elder monk. Durand slipped the jewels back into the sleeve, and the sleeve back into the case. He snapped it shut.
"Why?"
"It is the cost of entry to the Hulijing facility. $30 million up front, non-refundable, to create an account. Up till now, I did not have anyone who would be able to pass for clients of the Hulijing, whom I could also trust. But you, Mr. Durand, and your genetic consultant..."
He nodded to Frey, then turned back to Durand.
"We'll seem like just another couple of devilish foreigners here to take the change agent, to become someone else. In fact, the businessman's invitation fob is in this jacket."
Durand pondered this.
"They'll have biometrics on the client, iris, fingerprint."
"You forget what the Hulijing is doing, Mr. Durand. Anonymity is what they're selling. True anonymity. A post-identity world. A cleansing of earthly sins. There are no fingerprints or iris scans or even DNA scans that can identify their clients. There is only money and desire."
Frey nodded.
"It does rule out the looky-loos."
Durand gestured to the case.
"And once we're in, what then?"
The monk moved to the dinner jackets. He opened one coat and motioned to the sleeve.
"Concealed pockets, made specifically to hold ampules of their change agent. We know the precise size and shape of the glass ampules because we've ambushed their supply trucks before. The reagent itself does not seem to leave the facility, but we hope you and Dr. Frey will change that."
Frey's brow furrowed.
"How on earth are we going to get away with samples of their active change agent? I don't expect they'll be letting us into their labs."
"That's where you're wrong."
The elderly monk moved Durand in front of the mirror.
"Realize that among the nine tails of the Hulijing, faces and ethnicity are always changing. Instead, they have other means of proving their identity. Their marks of rank."
"Tattoos."
The monk nodded.
We are told Huli-Jing chromatophores reflect light at varying frequencies, notably ultraviolet. These patterns represent a unique three-dimensional key that, combined with its spectrographic signature, identify the bearer who activates them.
Durand pulled off his tunic and stood looking at his bare chest in the mirror. As he focused his will, he saw the tattoos begin to fade in. The more he concentrated on the Huli-Jing and what they had taken from him, on the stranger's face in the mirror, the darker his tattoos became. Soon, he stood before the mirror as Marcus Wicks, leader of the Huli-Jing. The elder monk gripped Durand's muscular shoulder.
You will become your enemy, Mr. Durand, and you will go where you will within his domain.
Frey cleared his throat.
Surely clients are watched at all times. In fact, they are tracked at all times, Dr. Frey. Every Huli-Jing client wears a tracking bracelet, which is why we've included these in your coat.
The old monk removed a long vanta-black glove from one of the coat pockets. It looked like a two-dimensional hole in reality.
Slip this over your bracelet arm. It will act as a Faraday cage, blocking the client tracking signal.
But security guards...
There will be a diversion to make it easier for you. The Huli-Jing facility will come under attack by rebel forces tonight at 2100 hours. If you have not found your opportunity by then, perhaps that will create one.
Durand turned to the monk with concern.
Resistance fighters are going to attack the Huli-Jing in the capital?
They will create enough of a diversion to keep the focus off you. When you've obtained your samples, you will resume your identity as a Huli-Jing client.
Durand pondered the plan.
Your people might get killed.
The elder monk just stared.
Some undoubtedly will. Knowing this, all have volunteered. They are willing to face the risk, Mr. Durand.
Bo Win volunteered, didn't she?
The elder monk stared.
That is not important.
It's important to me.
Mr. Durand, there is little time if you are to make your client appointment.
Frey stepped between them.
And what about me? What about the edit I came here for?
He gestured to Durand.
And that he came for. You know it will require weeks or months for a transformation. How's that going to work? We steal an ampule and then what? Hang around for months in a coma?
Durand was about to speak, but Frey cut him off.
Don't act as though you're pure of heart. You came here to get edited, to be restored to your original self.
He turned back to the monk.
Where does what we both came for fit into your plan?
The elder monk remained unmoved.
Your initial appointment for this evening is a consultation. The actual edits are usually scheduled later. Bring us the change agent on your return.